Hey, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, ever striving to be fact-based, open to divergent perspectives, and always actively optimistic. Today we're talking to Dr. Mark Sherrill. He's with the UW Aquatic and Fishery Sciences Department. He's also doing research for the United States Geological Survey Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Units. We love our salmon in the Pacific Northwest to the extent that they are iconic. Dr. Sherrill has been studying salmon for decades, and today he'll fill us in on how our salmon populations are doing and what they tell us about how well we are caring for our environment. So here we go. Dr. Mark Sherrill, welcome to Climate Talk.
Oh, thank you for having me, John.
So you're a professor at the University of Washington. You're in the Aquatic and Fishery Sciences Department, the way I understand it. So what does that department do and what do you do there?
Well, let's start with your second question.
Okay.
I am actually in a very, I would say, privileged position here. I'm technically a federal government employee. I'm actually a research ecologist with the United States Geological Survey in their cooperative units program. So my role here at the university is first and foremost as the, this is a long title, I'm the assistant unit leader for fisheries in the Washington Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit. And we are based here in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences and in the School of Environmental and Forestry Sciences at UW.
So do you teach there as well?
I do. My teaching load is one graduate course per year. So that's about half to a third of what most of my colleagues have. So that's a nice deal. And I also draw 12 months of salary, which is a nice deal. I don't have to go hunting for grant money to pay myself in the summer.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. I'm sure the students who get to take your class feel privileged being at the one and only per year. So a little more then about what your professional pursuits encompass.
Sure. Yeah. So here at School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences, we're quite diverse school. We do freshwater stuff. We do marine stuff. We do applied ecology. We do very basic research. And this runs the gamut, from cellular, molecular work, genetics, all the way up to large ecosystem studies. So sort of think of like the North Pacific Ocean or tropical oceans in the Pacific or Atlantic, even Indian Ocean for that matter. My research is primarily focused on freshwater systems and in particular Pacific salmon and other salmonids, fish in the salmon family, such as bull trout and rainbow trout, cutthroat trout, those sort of things.
So you sound like the guy that we want to be talking about today. So basically, I tend to see some things in our environment that have a little bit of an aspect of canary in the coal mine. Glaciers up in the Olympic Mountains, for instance, it's something that the layperson can see and understand. And another thing that laypersons can see and understand, I think, is salmon populations. And I grew up on the Rogue River down in Southern Oregon, and it's a salmon river. And people in the Northwest, I believe, there's a little bit of mystique related to salmon, and then of course their populations are an indication of how they're doing environmentally and so on. So let's just cut right to that, Jay. So how are our salmon populations doing?
Well, that's not an easy question to answer, John. It's actually much more complicated than that. I think in general, if you look across the west coast of North America, so from Alaska all the way down into California, which would include some areas in Idaho as well, you're going to find a mixed bag. There are going to be some populations or stocks, groups of populations that are really doing quite well and others that are struggling a bit, I'll say. I believe you've probably heard about the record salmon returns to Bristol Bay, Alaska this summer. The sockeye salmon run was just off the charts. Nobody had ever seen anything like that. And quite frankly, they weren't expecting to see that. Just to the north of there in the Yukon, populations of chum salmon and Chinook salmon are so low that they've restricted fishing heavily. Not even subsistence fishermen are able to get out there and do what they'd like to do. And those areas are not particularly far away from weather in the grand scheme of things. Sure, Alaska is a big state, but in general, we think of Alaska as a fairly pristine environment. There's not a lot of environmental degradation. The fisheries are generally Very sustainable. They're managed quite well. So this is a real conundrum. We don't really know why this is or what all of these sort of proximate factors are. I think if you come a little bit further south into the contiguous lower 48, same thing. We've got a mixed bag here. NOAA Fisheries is the organization at a federal level that's charged with the management and conservation of fishery stocks. For those purposes, they tend to group similar populations of a particular species in a location together to form what's called an evolutionarily significant unit. And about half of those evolutionarily significant units, or ESUs, are listed as threatened or endangered under the U.S. Endangered Species Act. Other half are doing pretty well, all in all, and that really depends on kind of where you look and when. So big trade-offs from year to year and from location to location.
Yeah, so I get the conundrum part of that. So one of the things I'm thinking about, just as an aside, I was born in Australia. I pay a lot of attention to what's going on down there. And one of the things that's interesting is that the kangaroo population is magnitudes higher now than when Europeans first arrived. So human impacts are sometimes difficult to parse out in terms of, okay, what the impacts are going to be. So do we see any of that in these disparities you're pointing to in the salmon population?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, in some cases, there are very clear effects, and those go back way into time, 200 years in some case. If you think about the development of large-scale fisheries, construction of hydroelectric dams, those sort of practices we've been doing for a long time based on reconstruction of cannery records in the lower Columbia, right around probably about 20 years ago, there was a big study that came out of Oregon State University, and they were able to estimate that from 1880 to 1920, they were harvesting about 85% of all salmon that were returning to the Columbia. And in many cases, they were using technologies that had not been used much in prior to that, large fish wheels that were very efficient at what they were doing. And we're still feeling some of those effects today. Certainly construction of hydroelectric dams, you know, that's gone on for a while. Some of those dams allow for passage of fish upstream or downstream. Others do not. So, you know, if you think about South Central Idaho, Hell's Canyon Dam on the Snake River, no salmon gets upstream of Hell's Canyon. But historically, they would have been able to do that prior to the dam structure. So for a long time, we kind of classified these factors as what we call the four H's. This was habitat, either loss or degradation, hydropower development, harvest, or in many cases, over harvest, and then the kind of development of hatchery fish, which we think often compete with wild fish and may harbor some diseases in hatchery situations as well. More recently, and probably germane to this conversation, we've really come to understand that climate change is having a really important effect, or maybe even more importantly, climate variability. So there's directional trends in climate, but also there's this kind of up, down, wiggle, wiggle from year to year that we just really don't understand.
Okay, so let's jump ahead for a second here to something I was going to ask you about since it's come up, and that is, how do we sort out anthropogenic impacts versus just natural variability? Can we do that?
Well, That is a really tough thing. And quite honestly, I've spent nearly 20 years working on that problem.
Okay.
And a lot of people have been working on it prior to my arrival, and they'll be doing it after I retire. So usually what it takes is we need some amount of data, right? If we don't have counts of fish from different locations and in different points in time, it's really hard to figure out if they're going up or they're going down. So in areas where we've had counts of these fish for a long enough period of time, we can tend to line up these time series of abundance of catches and also look at time series of things like ocean temperature or stream flows, stream temperatures, these sorts of things, and try to figure out, okay, are there correlations among those factors? But in many cases, that's really what we're dealing with, are correlations, sort of, you know, many, you know, your eyeballs can do the work for you. But certainly from a scientific perspective, we know quite well that correlation does not equal causing.
Right. Yeah. So I'm starting to feel a little challenged to my idea of salmon being a canary in the coal mine, because I think one of the things you're pointing out here is that the subject is far more complex than it could appear, especially in the popular media. I mean, if I read in the newspaper that that the salmon run through the Chittenden locks is at an all-time low, I automatically go to a place, well, we're not, as human beings, we're not treating the fish thoughtfully. But what I'm hearing you say is it's not quite that simple. Am I hearing you correctly?
That is correct. Yeah. I mean, in many cases, we know that there are going to be negative impacts of human actions, right? I mean, an analogy I use, if you put 100 well-trained fish biologists in a room and ask them to raise their hand if they think a large pile of concrete in the form of a dam in the river is good for fish, not one of them are going to raise their hand. But then you ask the same, same group of people, okay, what is the effect of that dam? Well, I mean, we're going to get 100 different answers. We're going to have some information. We're going to need to do some studies. Are we talking about Dam A on the Columbia or Dam B in the Upper Skagit? Something like that, right? So it is, yeah, it's a really tough question without a lot of very clear answers. I mean, certainly there's some that are pretty, if we're catching fish in fisheries, we're killing them, right? That's, that's a real obvious fact. But salmon are a species that in many ways can be exploited to a high degree, and they're very resilient.
So it seems to me that that this natural variability and the difficulty in identifying it can be used by folks who want to build dams or catch more fish and so on. So it seems like it's something that's really important to be able to sort out so we can set rational policy.
Yeah. And I think that's usually what happens is we try to learn from what we're doing, right? I mean, this is not new information to the fisheries world as well. Lots of natural resource managers try this, whether it's forestry or we're talking about managing ducks in the upper Midwest, wild horses in Nevada, something like that. Usually what it takes is some sort of decision to be made, an action that follows the decision, and then we monitor those populations and see do they respond positively or negatively to those decisions. We sit down, we reevaluate the new information we have, we make a new decision, move forward. So that's something we typically call adaptive management. So making decisions, responding to those decisions in light of new data.
So I'm just wondering if it's possible to take a, let's call it a simplified macro view of things. So if we look at the whole West Coast of, I mean, let's go up into Canada, Alaska, the whole West Coast of the North Pacific Ocean here, and the rivers that have salmon runs on them, are we doing about the same as, worse than, or better than we did historically in terms of numbers and size of the fish?
Well, that's not an easy question. There's sort of two aspects there. So maybe I'll tackle the second one first. We know now from a number of studies in the last 5 to 10 years that the size of fish at a given age is getting smaller up and down the coast. So 100, 200 years ago, a spring Chinook salmon swimming up the Columbia River would have been enormous. You and I would have had struggled to be able to pick that fish up. It would have been at least, 3, 4 feet long, probably pushing 50, 70 pounds. Now we don't see any fish that size anywhere in the Columbia. And some of that is an evolutionary response to fishing, because many fishing gears tend to select for larger animals. So over time, you remove the larger animals from the population, you end up with smaller animals. And that's, again, not unique to salmon or other fish. That's kind of just a very well-known phenomenon. So we know size at age, as we say, is getting smaller. We know that larger salmon tend to produce more eggs, and they tend to produce larger eggs. Larger eggs tend to survive better than smaller eggs, and there's more of them. So if we had the exact same number of fish, but they were all smaller, we would still think probably things are not as good as they used to be. And again, as I spoke to earlier in our conversation, the abundance of those fish really vacillates a lot up and down that coast. And some of that is due to the conditions they experience in the ocean environment. Some of that is due to the conditions they experience in the freshwater environment. But again, even if we look to an area like Alaska, where the fisheries are very well managed, the habitat is largely pristine and intact, there may be 10 to 25 years of periods of time where salmon tend to return at relatively low numbers, and then we'll have a switch, and then they start coming back gangbusters for 10, 25 years. That switch is often related to some change in the environment, but it's very hard for us to foretell when we're ahead of time.
Thinking about dams on the rivers, which you've referred to, one of the political things that's floating around is the idea of of taking dams down, breaching dams because of salmon runs. So once again, having grown up on a salmon river, my belief, and I don't know if it's a myth or not, it was a widely held belief, is that the salmon go back to the same place they respond. So is that true or is that a myth?
That is generally true, yeah. There is some straying. So some fish either get lost along the way or for some reason just choose to go elsewhere. But that's sort of 5 to maybe 10%. So in general, they are very true to where they were born. And it's remarkable when you think about a fish. Some fish is going to swim out of the Pacific Ocean 1,000 miles up the Columbian Snake Rivers and land, you know, not far from where it was born. It's quite remarkable. And most of that homing ability is based on smell. But we also know that they use some celestial aspects of it. They can sense differences in magnetic fields. There's some evidence that perhaps they're able to sense something to do like Ancient Mariners with the stars.
Wow.
Whatever. But mostly we think that's due to smell. And if you think a dog smells well, your average salmon is remarkable.
Well, yeah, there's some new facts for me about the fish that I didn't understand. So if we take those dams on this lower Snake down, breach them, how long is it going to take for the salmon to start populating the areas that they used to? And I know that there are some that still get up there, but I interviewed one of the guides up on the Salmon River, and he said that there are essentially no salmon there anymore. So if we breach those dams, are the salmon going to be able to find their old spawning grounds? I mean, their species' old spawning grounds.
Well, that's a great question. I honestly don't think anyone knows the answer to that. We do know that in some cases, especially in hatcheries, where fish will also return to where they were born. If they were born in a hatchery, they'll tend to show up at the hatchery again. And the reason that is because the hatchery is drawing their water that they use to raise those fish from an egg up to a juvenile from some source that's typically nearby. So if there was a hatchery population that we were using to maybe reintroduce salmon into an area where they had not been in a long time, they might very well go there if we could get water out of those systems, that sort of thing. So it's possible that they will. The other thing is that salmon we typically think of as a fairly weedy species. They were remarkable in the areas they will get into and the dangers they will face in order to get there. It is not uncommon that if we went up to Alaska, we'd see very small streams where bears might kill 95% of all adult fish in that stream. And in the process, you will see fish that are trying their best to dig a nest and spawn that have had big pieces of them taken by bears or seals in the, you know, on their way in. They are remarkable, the things they can tolerate and the places they will end up. So it's not inconceivable that if dams were removed, you might see fish moving into those areas. Now, the dams they're talking about in the lower Snake aren't really blockage dams in that sense. Right. The fish can pass up past those right now and have access to the areas they're in. It's just we're dealing with, you know, kind of a small numbers game.
Right. Yeah. So, those salmon, they spawn, they go up there, and once again, partly based on my own childhood experience, so those salmon die there mostly. We did believe that some males went back to the ocean. Is that a myth or is that true?
That only species of Pacific salmon that's true for are steelhead, which are a form of rainbow trout that will go to the ocean, come back, they may spawn, they may or may not go back to the ocean, but they can spawn again. But otherwise, the other species of Pacific salmon all die after spawning, males and females.
Okay. So those carcasses, do they have some role to play in the ecology of those spawning streams?
Absolutely. You at the top of the show, you talked about kind of salmon as an iconic species.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, they are immensely important from a cultural standpoint, right? Our state quarter has a salmon on it.
Right.
So people and certainly Indigenous peoples and Native Americans have held salmon in very hard regard since time immemorial. More recently, Western cultures have been enamored by them, but they're also enormously valuable ecologically. And it's not just at the time or post-death, but prior to their death. So imagine we've got a stream that's been sitting largely dormant for 9 months. Salmon start swimming up into the stream. They act sort of as a rototiller in a garden. Mm. They start turning up the stream bed, trying to dig nests in the bottom. This is displacing a lot of fine sediment and things that might otherwise smother eggs. They're kind of turning over the stream bed and getting it ready to go, and that happens on an annual basis. So that's really important. Then during spawning, they're depositing eggs into these nests, but they're a little bit sloppy about it. They're not like a bird who's, very carefully laying their eggs in a nest and kind of watching over them. A female's doing this, and some of these eggs are being displaced. And if you watch those happen, you won't have to wait very long before you'll see some other fish or birds or even small mammals in those streams and rivers eating those eggs. And they're very rich in proteins and fats, right? So it's an exceptional meal if they can get one. So the salmon could do their stuff. They die after spawning, and then their carcasses do act as essentially a fertilizer. So you can think of this as sort of a conveyor belt. Small fish go out to the ocean. They gain a bunch of size while they're there, maybe even 100 times what they were when they went out. And now when they return, they're carrying all these nutrients, phosphorus, nitrogen, calcium, potassium, et cetera, up from the ocean and depositing that all into these freshwater systems. Now, certainly some is washed back out again just due to flows, or when the juveniles grow up, they're taking that with them. But yes, it's essentially you have sort of the rototiller to start with, and then you're depositing. So a great analogy would be a gardener in the spring getting their gardens ready for planting, and then once they're planting, they got to fertilize those plants. So
Yeah, as a kid, I had direct experience with the salmon egg as food because I used to fish for trout on the Rogue River, and I always used salmon eggs, and I always caught trout. So you fleshed out a great more depth in terms of the impact of these fish up in the spawning streams, and it is quite amazing, and it does help to support this notion of the special relationship that we in the Pacific Northwest have, but especially the pre-European people who live in the Pacific Northwest, the relationship they had with those fish. So you've made a couple allusions to the ocean, and I heard you say up front that you specialize more in freshwater aspects, but is there anything we can say about climate change and what's going on in the ocean in terms of warming waters and increased acidity and so on that are affecting these fish?
yeah, absolutely. And to be honest, much of this information is relatively new in our understanding. I mean, some might be 25 years old, but that's pretty new in the study of fish when you think about how long people have been doing it. And I think for a long time, people viewed the salmon life cycle as really important on the freshwater side of things. That's where we can see them, right? As soon as they enter rivers and streams, you can start to see them. Many of them turn bright colors, so they're fairly conspicuous. You can count them. You can see what they're doing. You can capture the eggs. You can get juveniles. But as soon as they go out to the ocean, you pretty much just wave goodbye, wish them luck, and cross your fingers and hope you get some back in several years down the road. And for a long time, people sort of thought of that black box ocean as kind of an infinite source of productivity. I mean, that the rationale was like, well, why else would those fish go to the ocean unless there was something good out there for them? We do know now that the ocean is not sort of an infinite supply of food and that sort of thing, that it's rather somewhat limited. And it depends on who else is out there. So are there a lot of salmon kind of gathering in some places? At some point, we get to be what's called density dependent growth and survival. It's just like, if you were at a buffet table at a potluck, if you're the first person in line, you get all kinds of things to choose from. If you're that last person in line, by the time you get up there, there's somewhat slim pickings, right? But from a climate change perspective, yeah, the ocean is varying, and not just from a directional change standpoint, but this variability I talked about. There tend to be these stanzas, 10 to 25 years of sort of what we think of as very good ocean conditions and very poor ocean conditions. And what's really interesting about that is there's sort of an inverse production regime, as they refer to, between North Pacific areas, like around Alaska, and in the lower 48. So in time periods of time when Alaska stocks are doing very well, lower 48 tend to do maybe not so well. And then a switch will be flipped in the ocean. Stocks in the lower 48 seem to be doing pretty well. Those in Alaska, not so well. Now, more recently, we've seen, real obvious impacts of ocean warming. Several years ago, there was a phenomenon in the North Pacific, largely in the Gulf of Alaska, which was affectionately referred to as the blob. And this was a large section of the ocean, I mean, thousands of square miles, that was anomalously warm, many degrees warmer than people had ever really seen before. And the question was, well, what's this going to mean? Well, we got indicators all up and down the food chain. I mean, there were seabirds that were dying washing ashore. We saw small pinnipeds that were washing ashore, very emaciated, sick, starving, that sort of thing. And there were indeed noticeable impacts on some salmon stocks. Now, I say some because not everyone was a loser that year. And I think that's a really important aspect of salmon in general, that in any given year, there's going to be some winners and there's going to be some losers, but that's part of sort of the gamble that they play in this evolutionary game.
So, I think you used the past tense in referring to the blob. So is the blob still out there?
Well, I will admit right now, I haven't looked most recently to see it. It formed, lasted about a year and a half, sort of dissipated. It's come up again. This year, I think it's much more, quote, normal,
Okay.
but we don't know for sure what's going to happen. This is, and ocean warming also plays a really important aspect in equatorial regions. So you may have heard of El Niño, La Niña. That's a phenomenon that plays out in the equatorial Pacific, well east of us, I'm sorry, west of us. And as it gets really warm there, these warm areas of water tend to be pushed eastward up to the west coast of North America and pushed up along the coast. So in a very strong El Nino year, we have anomalously warm water off of the Oregon and Washington coast and all of the things that come with it. That's where the tuna fishermen start to go crazy because, oh my gosh, we got all these big tunas off there and there's jellyfish and all kinds of weird things that we don't typically see in a quote normal year, but they're kind of following that warm water patch. So it's not just sort of the North Pacific blob, but other areas of the ocean as well, where these effects are manifested thousands of miles away. And they refer to these as teleconnections.
So, how about acidification? I mean, is that an issue for salmon in the ocean?
Well, from what we understand, it's not a direct problem. The ocean is basic. The pH is above 7, so it's not particularly acidic, but it is becoming less basic or more acidic, right? So that's the way we refer to it. The direct effect on salmon is probably negligible, meaning, they're not shedding scales or having this weird thing. It's not like these crazy movies you'd see where someone's dropped in an acid bath. But the organisms that juvenile salmon eat when they first arrive, or even some species would continue to eat throughout their life, those are where we're seeing some changes as to what's going on. So a lot of the small animals or invertebrates in the ocean spend some of their life as a free-floating plankton, crabs, oysters, barnacles, these sort of things. And salmon and lots of other fish will eat those when they're small. Those lower trophic levels, these plankton, are showing some impacts of ocean acidification. So what that's going to mean for salmon in the future, you're going to have to wait around and see, I guess. But there's some indication that, yeah, the kind of the bottom of the food web is indeed changing due to ocean acidification, but we don't understand well what that means as we sort of move up through the food web.
Yeah, your reference to, I guess we're going to have to wait and see, reminds me of kind of a metaphorical look at climate change is that we're doing a global wide experiment and we're the lab rats in this experiment. And it's tough to make policy decisions, especially against opposition, when there are aspects of like, well, we don't really fully know the answer to that one yet. But then if we wait to find out what the answer is, maybe it's too late to, take remediation into consideration. So one of the things that I hear fishermen complaining about is mammal predation on the salmon population, sea lions, for instance. In fact, I boated a lot over the years and a lot of it up in British Columbia, and I was actually anchored up in a little hole up there for a few days during some stormy weather, and there were some commercial fishermen in there, and they were actually shooting seals. They had rifles with them. They were shooting seals because they felt that they were in competition for the fish. So, what role do mammals and other predators play in the lives of salmon?
Well, certainly there are animals out there that eat salmon. It's marine mammals, such as you alluded to, seals, sea lions, orcas. There's a species of shark called the salmon shark, which is fairly cryptic and not a lot known about, but what we do know is that they eat a lot of salmon. So yeah, these in essence would be competing with humans for their food source. But I think it's also important to recognize that those species would have co-evolved together well before there was any sort of humans on those populations. So that's just sort of a natural part of nature. And I think what's happening now is to some extent we're suffering from what's referred to as a shifting baseline syndrome. So people, you want to rel you know, people are looking for a ruler. You know, it doesn't matter if it's an index of inflation, you feeling this in your pocketbook, that sort of thing, or you're a fisherman and you're trying to figure out, well, was this year better than last year? Was this decade better than last decade? And most of us can only think kind of so far back, or you know, we know and you know, speak to some old timers, so to speak, and they'll tell you, oh, when I was a kid, we had this, that, and the other. Well, okay, well, that's long relative to my life, but you know, we in the grand scheme of things, that's relatively short period of time. So we do know that many marine mammals are increasing in abundance. That's due largely to things like the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which makes it
Okay.
illegal to harm, harass, or otherwise injure
Yeah.
these animals. So that's certainly having, you know, an impact. The other is that they're very social, and marine mammals learn from one another. So the young ones kind of figure out where the old ones are going, and they tag along and they figure it out. We see this in the lower Columbia River right now, downstream of Bonneville Dam, in areas like Astoria, where Californian stellar sea lions are starting to show up every spring and increasingly number more and more and more each year. And that's because it's a good place to be. They
Yeah.
realize that, boy, there are a lot of fish coming in here, and it's not just salmon, it's sturgeon and shad and a lot of other things. So some of this is, you know, and it tends to make the news as well. Orcas, you know, there's another very iconic species. Everyone loves to see baby orcas. We hate to see them when they're, you know, adults or babies are dying. You know, it really tears at the heartstrings. But the reality is, marine mammals have gone up and down over time, just like salmon have gone up and down over time, just like any other species. So what's the real role there? That's a hard one to say, because again, the shifting baseline syndrome, you know, we don't really have good information, good records from decades ago. We have a pretty good idea what's happening now, but you know, in the grand scheme of things, is that a big effect or a relatively small effect?
Yeah, it's tough to know what to do with stuff because I mean, just hypothetically, let's say that we decided that sea lions were adversely impacting the salmon population. So then we're going to start culling out sea lions or something like that. We don't know what impact that's going to have either. So it's really a challenge being a human being on the earth and not interfering in a way that's damaging to us and our environment, which we're dependent on. And I think that's a big chunk of what we're up against, and that's what we're talking about here, basically.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a really good point. And one of these is, you know, with respect, like you were alluding to before, removal of, or possible breaching of the lower four dams on the Snake River, or it's culling marine mammals or even seabirds. That's been another hot topic. What should we do with them? Well, if we want to do those natural experiments, that's great. But I think from a science endeavor, what we also need to do is establish beforehand, how are we going to monitor what our effects are, and how are we going to evaluate those effects? Because absent that sort of analysis, we just don't know, right? We have
Yeah.
stories, we have all this anecdotal evidence, but we need to be able to cast that in a much more rigorous framework, especially when we're dealing with, you know, federal laws like Endangered Species Act or Marine Mammal Protection Act, those sort of things, where the basis for listing or delisting is in fact counts of animals. So if we're not going to count those things, we're not going to know. And I think an important point that comes up, dams in particular, it's a pretty convenient spot to count fish. You can count adults going upstream there, and you can count juveniles going down. We remove those, it becomes much harder to count those. Now, like I said, I don't think that's the dam's primary
Right.
purpose, and I don't think we should keep them around just for that sake. But as a scientist, I think it would be a shame to undertake those sort of very large ecosystem scale experiments and not try to figure out what that means from an ecological as well as a social perspective, right? There's a lot
Right.
of aspects there.
So it seems like one of the things I'm hearing you say is that policy to be effective has to be very well studied, very well thought out based on measurable data. Yet it seems like most of the time our policy is set by who can bring the most political clout to the table rather than those things. So I'm just wondering, in your experience, and I guess I'm asking you for an opinion here, what is your view of how closely regulatory agencies and elected officials, how closely do they pay attention to what the scientists have to say?
Well, I think they do a lot, honestly. I think the narrative you just opened with is, I think, a common one. And we see a lot of that. We hear a lot about that in the media. lobbyists getting a chance to sort of basically write bills that reflect positively on what they are. But in my experience, when I sit down with elected officials or policymakers to discuss what's going on, they want to know why, how,
okay.
right? Because if they're not making sound decisions based on real information, that's going to come back to bite them. They are responsible to taxpayers and voters, and those people want to make sure that their money is being spent well. And you have to be able to turn around and say, okay, why did you make that decision? Well, I made that decision because I played golf with somebody on Monday. It's not really going to work very well, right? It's like, my staff has paid a lot of attention to what's been going on. We've had discussions with scientists who know these things inside and out. Based on that information, we are going to. So I think it's really that most of those people are acting in society's best interest.
Okay, well, that's really reassuring, and it's a positive note, and we're close to the end here, so maybe we'll just hang on to that positive note. I mean, it's nice to know that scientists are getting a reasonable amount of attention paid to them when these really critically important decisions are being made. So what could you offer to folks who are concerned about climate change in general, but also looking at salmon populations and other things related to the salmon? Where should we look for information, and what can we do if we want to be active around this issue?
Yeah, this is a great question, John. I'm glad you asked this. So a few different tacks. One is there's a lot of great information out there that's very accessible to the public. We live in the age of information with respect to the internet. Relatively simple Google searches for something like salmon, climate, these sorts of things will get you some information. The Washington State Governor's Office has quite a bit of information on their websites about salmon recovery. The Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife has some great information about salmon. National Marine Fisheries Service, or NOAA Fisheries, as they're referred to often, also has some really great information. So if you just kind of want some high-level stuff, okay, what's going on? Who's doing well? Who's not doing well? Where are these problems? You're going to find all kinds of information. I think as a concerned citizen, you can exercise your power to vote. Research these, see who's got the animals, fish, wildlife, natural resources in their best interests, and do they align with your interests? And then in those cases, support the candidates that you think are good. The other one that I think doesn't get as much attention, but I think is important, is that from a consumer standpoint, there are a lot of very sustainable fish species out there that are exceptional choices as a consumer who's looking for a great meal. There's a bumper sticker that you can find in Alaska that totes around, and it says, "Save a wild salmon, eat one." The idea there is that those fisheries are very well managed, very sustainable. And the idea that if you buy wild-caught, sustainable salmon, you're helping those communities and those individuals who rely on that for their livelihood. And it's not just the fishermen, right? It's the people who sell gas, sell nets, repair boats, all these sort of things. And the other thing is that a lot of salmon fishermen also fish for other things in different seasons. So you can do your homework and figure out, oh, what are some of the other sustainable fish species, or crabs, clams, mussels, those sort of things, oysters to eat as well. And organizations like the Monterey Bay Aquarium produce a great list, sort of a stoplight chart of green, yellow, red. These are great. These are kind of mad. These would be things to definitely avoid. So as a consumer, educating yourself about what choices are out there is a great thing. If you go into a restaurant, ask, do you serve, where is your fish coming from? Where is your seafood coming from? Those sort of things. And if they can't tell you, that's probably a flag. If they, some places now will say right on their menu where they're getting that information from. So support those restaurants and other organizations that are selling good stuff and know where their fish is coming from.
So that's a terrific summary. And it's an accessible and understandable kind of little list of things to do. So I'm speaking for myself and listeners, really thanks for that. And also just want to personally reinforce this notion of how important our votes are and how important our communication with our elected officials are. I think a lot of people underestimate what their impact is there. So Dr. Mark Sherrill, it's been a real pleasure talking with you today. I've learned a lot. And even having grown up on a salmon river, a lot of stuff that I learned today that I didn't know before. So thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, John. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks so much to Dr. Sherrill. I think that taking care of our environment, including the greenhouse gas content of our atmosphere, here in this latter stage of industrialism is critically important to our future as a species. The short version is there are a multitude of indicators that we are not doing well enough in taking care of our environment. Taking care not only for ourselves, of course, but for future generations. Declining salmon populations, declining salmon size, those are indicators amongst thousands of others that we must do better. I'll add that as citizens and voters, we will make a bigger and better contribution to where we're headed going forward, the better we are informed. Just having a static ideology and a worldview are not adequate to the task at hand. You can contact me at john@ccltacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. Check it out, a bunch of good people. Join up or find another organization if you aren't already attached so that you can join your voice with others. This program, along with all other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under programming. So until we talk again, remember, all great victories were almost great defeats, and always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.